Hello and welcome. It's another Books of the Year podcast from your friends at Books of the Year, the people who make podcasts. Very good book for you in just a moment. An email from Lorraine says, Simon and Matt, I've only recently come across your podcast, and which I find hard to believe given that...
We've been going for ages,
in all the
Lorraine.
Research, people say that we are the number one books podcast.
Has that come across, has it? Oh, right. Yeah. Good.
Anyway,
good,
as it continues, your same banter and camaraderie, which is the backbone of your Drive Time show.
Backbone.
And I'm thoroughly enjoying it. As many others have said, the podcast has introduced me to books and authors that I would previously not have considered. Recent downloads to my Kindle include Abigail Dean and Chris Whitaker, both which I discovered thanks to your pod. I still prefer the feel of a real book, though, and have been visiting my local library frequently. I recently borrowed Bad Money by Jodi Picoult, a long-time favourite of mine, and Jennifer Finney Boylan, both of whom were on your podcast a couple of years ago. Whilst browsing the shelves last week, I stumbled across a book by a certain Simon Mayo called Knife Edge.
Yes!
I absolutely loved it. I've also now placed a reservation on TikTok. This is very, very
good. Yes, very good.
I didn't realise this was just going to be a piece of self-promotion.
Imagine how this got through.
Keep up the good work. Your podcast has elevated my morning dog walks to a whole new level of fun. Lorraine, that is why we're here.
Indeed. An email from Gareth in Taunton. Dear Bookish Ones, just a quick note to say thank you for featuring Francis Spufford on the pod. I've been a fan of his for quite a while, but not sure I've ever heard him speak about his writing before. I really enjoyed Nonesuch, genre-bending in the best sort of way. Nice one, lads, says Gareth.
And it was good having Francis on. And yes. He was right at the very beginning of his promotion.
He was.
So he was trying to work it all out as we went along. You can email us at any time, books. Yahoo.com. We're on Instagram, Threads, and Blue Sky, Books of the Year. And we've got some great recommendations coming up. Anthony Horowitz, Michael Connelly, and Matt Haig, to name just a few. Make sure you follow and subscribe to the pod so you never miss an episode. And look out for our YouTube channel coming soon. Did
YouTube?
You know about that?
Oh, indeed.
Makeup and wardrobe
is
going to be guaranteed. Okay, top guest, top book on the way. All right, let's talk to John Lanchester. Hello, John, how are you?
Hi, Simon.
It's very nice to see you.
You too, thanks for having me.
Are you excited?
I am.
I don't mean about being on the podcast, but...
Obviously, taken as a gift.
You've had many, many successful fiction, non-fiction books out. Is it still a buzz?
It is. I mean, it's still both exciting and scary in exactly the same way. I think the main thing is because when you're writing, you have control. You know, if you want the weather to be nice, you make the weather nice. If you want the colon to be a semicolon, you can do it. You know, like full control of everything. And then as soon as it comes out, it's like the roller coaster's gone to the top and you're let go. There's not a single thing that's up to you. And that's thrilling, but also quite scary.
Yeah. So it's out there.
It's out there.
Okay. And we will endeavour to tell as much of the story as we can without spoiling anything. Matt, of course, will tell us about the UK cover.
Yes. And it is a cover that I think it's a great cover. It's one that you will have seen on adverts quite a lot because it's such an arresting image. And it's basically, it's a stuffed olive pierced by a cocktail stick with Look What You Made Me Do embossed on the green olive from the best-selling author of Capital above it. Then John Lanchester behind and all on a big white background. But it's quite an arresting image.
It is. And this is the cover that we have. But tell us about the other covers, John, because there's obviously an awful lot of work goes into not just the title, but also what this looks like and how the book presents itself in the bookshop. How is it being taken elsewhere?
The Faber cover is very striking, I think, and I really like the image of skewering, and there's something quite kind of specific about the social setting of the olives. You know, there's an Instagram account called Real Housewives of Clapton.
You see that?
And they're completely obsessed with Pirello olives, and they have like children called Pirello and stuff like that. So it's very good sociologically. The German cover, which I was just looking at, has this sort of image of it's blue and blue, black and white, and it's a face which is sort of frowning. And in German, it's called Das habe ich wegen dir getan, which is something like, you know, I did something to you. Apparently, it's quite hard to translate, it's not identical. And that's much more psychological, thrillerish, slightly creepy. It doesn't quite tell you what the tone of the book is, I think, on purpose. And oddly enough, you know, when I was writing it, I thought it was a psychological thriller. And when the response came back from the editor, so I thought I'd written a psychological thriller, and they came back and said, no, it's actually a black comedy about intergenerational resentment. Oh, okay. It's a black comedy about intergenerational resentment.
You're talking about the same book.
Same book. And oddly, I think the German cover and the American one, which is a sort of abstract thing of slightly tortured, it's a rather beautiful image, but it's a cold image of leaves and plants in the background, and then the lettering is white. And both of those are, I'd say, more on the psychological thriller side than on the comedy side.
How is it, with all your experience, John, how is it that you thought you'd written a psychological thriller, but when your editor came back, they said, no, it's a black comedy?
I think it's because I was thinking so much about the plot and the structure. The main work we went into book when I was writing it, and particularly when I was planning it, was on getting the plot right. And the plot is a backwards and forwards thing between two women. And the sort of the story beats, the structure, the tension between the characters are very much like that of a psychological thriller. And I was so focused on that that I think I didn't notice the tone of the way they talk, and that's where the comedy is. I think I've only got one general idea about life, really, at all, which is that it's comic in texture and tragic in structure. And I think all my books reflect that to some extent. I think what happened here was I was so focused on the structural thing that the kind of tone slightly achieved itself in a way without me realizing it.
So were you pleased to be told it's a black comedy?
Yeah, I'm very happy to be told what it is, because I kind of don't know what it is when I'm writing. I know it's like, I think of books as objects, you know, I make a thing, and then what people use the thing for or how they see the thing, that's slightly up to them. So I'm never, I never take the hump if someone thinks differently from it the way I thought of it.
We've explained absolutely nothing about the story. So introduces to, you've mentioned the two women, and obviously if it's a black comedy and a psychological thriller, there are limits to what you can tell us, but introduce us to our two main players here.
Well, the two main characters, Kate is a woman in the latter part of her 50s. She's what Bridget Jones would have called a smug married, married to an architect called Jack, and they're prosperous, comfortable, well-meaning, nice, in quotes, though maybe less nice than you think over time. And the book starts with Kate just talking about their life, they're going out to dinner party. And then the second main character is Phoebe Mull, who's a screenwriter. She's sort of done her time in the trenches in various writing rooms, and she's just about, when we first meet her, she's just about to have her first show, which is a Netflix show called Cheating, just about to come out. And all the early signs are that's going to take off like a rocket. And the story is about the relationship or lack of relationship between them and the ways in which their lives collide and overlap. And there are a number of twists and turns, but I suppose one of the main ones is that Kate starts seeing things in Phoebe's show that it's not possible for her to have known. And that's what the great sort of mystery and propelling, inciting incident, I believe.
And one of the things, so Kate, at the start of the book, is married.
She's married to Jack. And spoiler, but the book begins with an abrupt bereavement. That's where the story kicks off.
Okay.
So before we get there is going to be a part of this book that I know Simon and I, when we were reading this straight away, this was the thing we were talking about, and I've seen it come out in reviews.
I know what you're going to say.
Yes,
and so does John.
John, because it's such a great line, is the line about Ottolenghi and Ottolenghi's impact on this country. I'm going to ask you to spoil it, John, but it's such a great line. So talk us through that.
It's to do with the character of Jack. You know, he's a lovable, warm, funny, / bumptious and annoying. And I was just, you know, you do this odd thing, you sort of channel characters' voices. And I found when I was describing this dinner party, Jack just came out with his monologue about Ottolenghi having done more damage to Britain than the Luftwaffe, which I don't at all think, by the way.
So my bet was that is what you think. So
there was a thing when you go out to dinner, before the pandemic, so in that terrifying way, it's probably sort of, I think it's 2 years ago, but it's probably sort of 8 years ago. And it would be absolutely every single time you went out, it was Ottolenghi. I remember, I think we went out four times we went out to someone's house for supper in a row, and it was Ottolenghi. And I remember thinking, saying to my wife, because, you know, I think we're all old enough to remember Peak Delia, When there's those Delia Smith cookbooks, they were absolutely, and people, everybody was using Delia simultaneously. But even that, I don't think reached the level of cultural penetration that Ottolenghi did in that moment where you just, you know, everything was pomegranate molasses.
Yes.
And, you know, jeweled rice. I still think it's funny that there's something called jeweled rice. So Jack does have a riff on the subject of, as I say, more damage than the Luftwaffe.
No, it's a great line.
And very unfair, also, because I was thinking, if I'd been at the dinner party, I'd have been the person that says, I think you're talking bollocks. I like Ottolenghi, and... because Jack appears to... we see it from Kate's perspective, so therefore she's heard all this before. Here we go, you're going to do the Ottolenghi routine. But obviously the bait is taken, is it not?
The bait is taken, yeah. Partly because the host does, as he says, and actually not the host, one of the guests says, I cook Ottolenghi all the time, he says. No, I mean, I do think the sociology of food is interesting. I used to write about restaurants, so it's something I've watched over years. Few things have changed in terms of the texture of daily life in this country quite as much as attitudes to food and eating out and the kind of food we cook. And it's a great index of change. One of the things that's very useful about it in fiction is that it conveys an awful lot of information very quickly about who people are, how they see themselves, how they want their lives to be. I mean, there's a funny thing about Britain. We publish and read more cookbooks than any other country in the world. We don't necessarily cook more, but we publish and read more cookbooks. And I think that's an index of change, because if you cook and live the way your grandparents lived, if you basically cook your grandma's food, you don't need a cookbook. So in countries like France, where there is a lot of cultural continuity, Italy too, a lot of cultural continuity in the food people eat, that they, you know, they have cookbooks, but nothing like on the scale that we buy them. And I think that's the thing, it's about an index of change and possibility, and you know, we could live in a different way. That's one of the things that people use cookbooks for a kind of different idea of themselves about who they want to be.
These are smug London people that you're writing about. Is the Ottolenghi, I mean, we can get hung up on that, it's a very good sequence, but is it symptomatic of London? Is it very much a London issue? If we were to go around the country, would people be nodding at this point the way Matt and I have done?
I think so. I mean, certainly so far I've been out and about a bit with this book, and I've had Ottolenghi conversations that were outside the N25, let's put it like that.
Okay.
I want to talk to you more about Phoebe, because of the two, Phoebe was the one that I warmed to the most. I'm not sure whether I'm supposed to warm to her, but I certainly did. And part of the reason is she goes for dinner with her agent, and this agent comes in, and for the first sort of couple of pages with him, where he feels like this sort of bumbling, awkward guy who's not quite sure. And then he absolutely skewers her at this meal in this very nice restaurant, where he says, "You're a bit of a bully," and effectively then tells her how she's not a very nice person, but is saying, "That's absolutely fine, just don't pretend to be something you're not." And the reason why I like that is because Phoebe puts up no counter argument there at all. She's, "Yeah, no, that's pretty much me." Is it felt like that is something that's very current, in that if you have the ability to appear not to be shamed by anything or by anyone, you have an enormous amount of license to do whatever you want. Now, is that me reading too much into it and bluntly being, you know, binging on current affairs and stuff like that I am at the moment? Or was that in your mind as you were writing, Phoebe?
I think it's a really interesting way of putting it. I was interested in the thing that definitely overlaps with that, which is that I think life's easier if you are what British call nice, i.e. you know, polite, friendly, amiable, agreeable as far as possible, and just that's the kind of default setting for interactions with other people, as being nice. But plenty of people don't think that. I've always been quite curious and interested in people who don't, you know, who are deliberately slightly spiky, slightly awkward. There's a very useful French word, which you could well say that, you know, it's typical that French have a word for it, pénible, which means sort of difficult on purpose. It means making every interaction with them slightly harder than it needs to be, just as a kind of, that's your default setting, being awkward, difficult, not agreeing, spiky, saying no. And, you know, Phoebe is pénible. And that was the kind of dominant note of her character. That's where I wanted it to start. I'm just super curious about that, and because it seems to me life must be so much harder actually if you're like that. But of course you make a good point that in fact in lots of ways having a thick skin and being oblivious and not caring what people say is sort of, these days, an actively a big advantage.
It's almost Johnsonian. You know, when Johnson was prime minister, he seemed to have no shame. Trump seems to have no shame. I wonder if social media made that worse, do you think?
It might well have. Might well have made it a more of an advantage. And I noticed that there's a thing very close to this that you know, quite, if you're in the wrong, you do something wrong, you offend someone, blah, 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 you say sorry. They never say sorry, either of them. Absolutely ever. In a way that is clearly a lesson that they feel they've learned about how you should conduct yourself in public life, that it's vital to never show a sign of weakness by apologising. It's a really strange and striking thing, because actually apology often is the beginning of a form of connection. You say, oh yeah, I did cock that up, and you sort of reset, start again, people trust you more. And it's interesting that they're men who both levels of trust decline very steadily. But and it's quite an easy fix to say sorry when you're very, very, very obviously wrong. But in their case, even though everybody on the planet could see they're in the wrong, they just won't go there.
I'll tell you the other reason why I liked Phoebe is, so she's, as you've already said, she's a writer of this TV show that's on Netflix, and it's absolutely caught fire. It's one of those things that everyone is talking about. And at the centre of this show is a guy who's married and is having an affair with this younger woman. And obviously the dynamic within the book is this based on a real experience that Phoebe has had? And Phoebe in the book is not deflecting that at all. She's not confirming it, but she's certainly not denying it either. And the reason why I liked it is I thought, putting myself, as difficult as that may be, put myself in Phoebe's position where I'm having an affair with an older man and he's telling me stuff about his wife and their marriage. It's gold. How am I not going to use that? Of course I'm going to. And any writer will say straight away, that I'm sorry, that's just too good. Was that something that you felt about her as well, about Phoebe? So a little bit of an excuse for her to be able to mine that particular scene, because it's just too good. It's too good to pass up.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about Phoebe, I feel the trajectory of our feelings with the two characters is sort of opposite, that you start quite close to Kate because she has this bereavement, and then, well, yeah, you do get more distance from her, and you see that her character is slightly more complicated than this sort of nice, content, smug married is. It's sort of her character's darker than that. And Phoebe, it's sort of the other way around. You see the initial spikiness and difficulty, and then you realise some of the reasons for that, and the sort of trajectory of the feelings, I think, changes. And I think one of the less good things about Phoebe is that she's opportunistic. Mm. She'll snatch on things and she'll use things to her advantage. The flaws in Kate's character are more systematic and colder, and she'll go to greater lengths than that. So I did think of a kind of moral accounting between the characters, and the ones, you know, the one's flaws are actually bigger than you think, and the other's flaws in a way lesser. Because, yes, she is opportunistic in a classic writerly magpie. I mean, I've got various writer friends who was once turning up at someone's house. They had a small child, and the child had been sick on their jacket.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
In that classic way. And the person behind me said, oh, I like your epaulettes of vomit. And the person behind me was a novelist, so I went saying, oh, I'll be having that.
That could be the title of your next book.
Exactly. Epaulettes of vomit, yeah.
I think the French translation of that would be very good.
It would be probably something to do with typical English.
Yes. But penible is my favourite new word. I'm going to cherish that one. Does it spoil too much to explain Phoebe's relationship with her mother and the her classification of narcissistic mothers? Because that was fantastic.
Yes. A lot of Phoebe's motivation does come from her very, very damaged, messed up, unhealthy relationship with her mother. And there's a bit where she talks about these different types of toxic parent being bitch, vampire and squid, and that the thing about her mother is that she can manage to be all three simultaneously.
Yeah, I particularly like the squid, who, because it's not just narcissistic mothers. There are many people, I think, as we meet, who manages, like, they spread their ink over and their mood affects everyone that they're with. I think there are lots of people like that.
I did pinch that from a friend, actually, the thing about the squid. Yeah, I found it very helpful to have it described, that thing about the people who, I was going to say uncontrollably, but in a way that's the point, is whether they can control it, because sometimes you think they could and choose not to. But I think about people whose mood just contaminates the air around them, and if they walk into a room, you can tell them they're in a bad mood.
Can it be positive? Can you be a positive squid?
I think you can have that thing of people whose mood is infectious in both directions. But actually, in a way, is it better? I mean, because then it means that, you know, as with the good kind, not just the bad times mm-hmm. are conditional on how they're feeling, but the good times are conditional on them too. And so they're both a form of sort of recklessly asserting power. And I think the thing that it becomes very damaging is when you realise people can control it and they're kind of choosing to do mm-hmm. it.
Can you just explain a bit more about you mentioned at the beginning when you thought you'd written a psychological thriller and it came back as a black comedy, but I think you also said it's about intergenerational conflict. Can you just explain a bit how that develops and why you wanted to explore that?
Well, that was one of the things. Stephen King's rather good book on writing. I'd recommend it to any aspiring writers. He talks about the first draft, you just get black on white, which is the best advice anyone's ever given. You just get it, get the words on the page. And then when you read through it and you go over it a second time, that you saw that in a way is when you realise what it's about. You see it. And it wasn't in my head when I was writing the first draft, but I suddenly thought, oh, actually, this tension and conflict between Kate and Phoebe actually maps onto this generational thing, which is broadly speaking, boomers versus millennials. I mean, I think a lot of the talk about that is overdone, it's too systematic, it sort of comes from a marketing impulse to categorise us and divide us and chop us up into segments. But at the same time, there's no point pretending there aren't real tensions. And one of the things when Phoebe looks at Kate, she sees someone who's with this unearned privilege and this thing of, you know, feeling that life is basically fair, and it's because they bought their house in the 90s. You know, they bought a house in the 1990s and now it's worth, you know, million or whatever quid. And therefore they think life is fair and they're geniuses and they know how everything works and everything is, you know, orderly and just in our society. And that tension is a very real thing, I think, you know, because I've got kids in their 20s, so I see both perspectives.
I was going to ask you how much of what we view in this book is from your perspective as a middle-aged guy with two adult children, because their perspective will be, well, we didn't buy a house, we are going to struggle, we might never own a house.
Yeah, it's definitely a thing. I mean, one of the peculiarities, though, is that you know, contrary to rumor, that the older generations will eventually die off, and then you're going to have this odd thing that intergenerational rivalry that we currently have, this tension between generations, is suddenly going to be this thing that, you know, people who are at school and uni together and, you know, all think they're in essentially the same world in terms of career and economics and the trajectory of life, suddenly some of them are lottery winners because of just the postcode their parents bought houses in. And so you have this shift from intergenerational rivalry to intragenerational rivalry. You'll suddenly have this, you know, some people lottery style winners kind of popping up out of nowhere. So I think that tension is definitely there and definitely real. And then it's going to feed and become this other rather strange thing of this sudden arrival of inequality inside a generation. Because obviously there's class and economic equalities always been there. But this thing, it'll happen, you know, from one day to another. People die, they inherit tons of money, and they suddenly realise that they're not in it together.
It's a rich scene. I noticed there's a parody account on X that has just emerged over the last few days when we're recording this. It's a parody account of this sort of elderly couple talking about their house and how I just took a few extra shifts in the 70s at the post office and look at my house now. If only the generation now would do the same. That's their problem. That's why they can't afford a house. And of course, the house they're showing is this amazing 1.3 million place in Berkshire. Now, so
and one that drives young people mad is the coffee one.
Yeah, absolutely. With your smashed avocados, yeah. And then you'd be don't subscribe to Netflix, don't have an iPhone, and then you'll have a house.
Yeah.
Ridiculous. But here's a question where I'm going to be very, very careful, John, and you should too, but you should also respond as much as you can. Because when you've been talking about this book, You've mentioned this intergenerational, the psychological thriller and the dark comedy. And you've not mentioned the word that I wrote down when I finished it this morning, and that is a book about revenge. But if we talk about revenge, I love this book, and I want as many people as possible to read this book and to be as delighted and have the rug pulled from underneath them as I was. Talk to us as much as you can about how revenge is a theme within this book, because it is super.
Revenge definitely is a theme. I mean, there's a thing, there's a heroic period in English literature in the Elizabethan Jacobean period when the kind of great genre was called revenge tragedy. Hamlet's the classic example of revenge tragedy. And someone said to me jokingly, well, it's kind of a revenge comedy, isn't it? Which I thought was quite funny. Yeah. It struck me, because I think that is one way of describing it. Yeah, there is revenge. And I suppose the question, I think the reader probably realises that quite early, but the question is, who's taking revenge on who and for what? And one of the things in the book, revenge feeds into it, I think that's always interested me is, in a way, the question of what a story is the same question as who gets to tell it. The person who tells a story is the person who determines its meaning. And one of the contests in the book is to do with that. Kate and Phoebe are fighting over whose story this is and who gets the last word and who's the narrator. I've always been interested in that because I always think that how you tell the story, what the story is and who tell it are actually the same question. And that theme is very much played out through this topic of who's getting revenge on whom.
This might be a strange question to ask, but does your personality, John, come through in your book? Does the person you are affect the characters and the kind of judgments that we're going to make as we read this book?
It probably has to, but not consciously. It's definitely not something I think about much. And my novels are quite different from each other, and I think that's partly because I'm just not that person. You know, I occasionally get people come up to me, 30 years to the month since my first novel came out, and people sometimes come up and say they've read it, they say nice things about it. And
that was the fake autobiography of the chef.
That's right. He's a crazed. He pretends he's writing a cookbook, but it's actually a novel. And then you gradually realize it's a murder story, and that he's a psychopath. And he's a snob, food obsessed psychopath serial killer. And the single question you're most often asked about it when it came out is it autobiographical? I still haven't worked out how to answer that. But it's always nice to hear people have read it. But at the same time, you know, I think in a really strong sense, I'm actually not that person. I'm not the person who wrote it. And this is a large and deep question, but I think the continuity and stability of our self is exaggerated. I think Western society, we regard the self as a kind of building that's a permanent structure that's there forever. And I do think the self is much more fluid, and we do profoundly change, and we are in profound senses not the same people over time. And even if it were the case that it expressed my personality when I was writing it, you know, it is a few years since I started writing it, and I'm not sure I'm that guy anymore. And by the way, I'm not disclaiming it or stepping away from it or disavowing it or any of those things. I just do think that the thing about our personality is less, you know, it's not really set in concrete. And books, for me, it's like a snake skin that I kind of shed. You know, that was a version of me, and I'm not that person anymore.
It came out of a conversation. My wife is a ceramicist, and she is of the opinion that part of her does, however obtuse it looks and whether anyone else gets it, some of her comes through in her work as she's sculpting the piece that she's on. And I just wondered whether that was true for authors.
I think it probably must be true, but not consciously. The interesting thing about ceramics, by the way, is, because I write fiction and non-fiction, a thing that sometimes comes up is I'm asked about the difference. And I think that they have more in common than they have apart. And when people talk about fiction, they sometimes think it must come from some Latin word, fictio, means I make things up. But actually, it's the past participle of the verb fingere, which is the Latin word to shape on a potter's wheel. Ah. It's the fingers that shape a thing on a potter's wheel. So that thing about ceramics, it goes very, very... That's the birth of fiction in the sense of making and shaping and structuring.
There's a fantastic American songwriter who I love very much called Jason Isbell. And he said, I'm trying to get this right, he said, the mark of a... You know that you're a great songwriter or a good, he probably said, songwriter, when you can write a song in the first person and it has absolutely nothing to do with you.
Yeah, I like that. I think I agree with that.
I think that's fascinating. We've learnt an awful lot on this conversation. And here's a hackneyed question. You were born in Germany, I think, and you grew up in Hong Kong. Does that make you an outsider? Do you look at British society and the kind of smug London that you're writing? Do you look at it differently because there's part of you that is slightly different and other?
A little bit, I think. I think I've never met a writer who doesn't have some form of displacement. It can be due to class, gender, ethnicity, geography, psychology, whatever. There's always something that slightly doesn't fit. And I do think for me it's that geographical thing. My dad had a British passport, but he never lived in Britain. He grew up mainly in Australia and Hong Kong. My mum was Irish. I grew up mainly in Hong Kong, moved around in Asia for a bit. And I do think that just, I'm not a victim, I'm not playing a violin, but, you know, I do have a slight sense of not being quite from anywhere. There's a thing someone said about V.S. Naipaul, the tricky question for his characters is always, where are you from? And that is a slightly tricky question for me. But it's one of the reasons I like London, because lots of people from here are from somewhere else. There's lots of people who, you know, adopted this place rather than born here. And I'm absolutely that person.
Yeah. Billy Bragg used to talk about everyone having a lot of people having two flags to wave. And it sounds that you have quite a number of flags to wave.
I like that. That's really good. Two flags.
What I really hope for this book, John, is because it is a fantastic, it's one of my favourite books of the year, is that it becomes a series on Netflix. Because there would be something enormous, I don't know, profound about that, or complete.
It might be a kind of self-referential implosion, though. It might accidentally form a cultural black hole and everything disappears into it.
I mean, your Capital was a successful TV show. What is going to happen to this? Do you know?
When I was conceiving it and thinking of it, Phoebe was going to be a novelist. Then I had to scrap that idea because it couldn't. I was really interested in that thing of a cultural phenomenon that's absolutely everywhere. And in fact, you only really get that with telly. Even films, you don't get them quite the same way. It's telly is the thing that everybody's talking at the same time. And so, okay, she can't be a novelist, she has to be a screenwriter. And I did think at that point, well, you know, the book will work better, but it'll kill it from the adaptation point of view, because nobody's going to make a TV series about a TV writer having a hit. And my hunch is, because they're pretty rare. There's that thing, The Studio, which is very funny about Seth Rogen. But by and large, telly doesn't like making things about telly. Film likes making things about film, but not telly about telly. We'll see. But you're right, it would be properly funny.
Yeah. Well, let's hope that happens, and maybe Netflix will love themselves so much that they love this book so much that they'll take this on. John Lanchester, thank you so much for coming in, and there'll be more with John in our Q&A, which will be within a few days' time. But for the moment, John, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.